Welcome, podcast friends. We're back with volume 6 of the Best Investment Writing Series. Each year, our team carefully sorts through tons of research and investment letters from some of the most respected money managers and investment researchers from all over the world to pick the best of the best to share with you. We offer the authors of those pieces the chance to record an audio version as a segment of the podcast. Past participants included the likes of Cam Harvey, Larry Swedrow, and Rob Arnott. Before we get to the episode, a quick word from today's sponsor. Stream by AlphaSense is an expert transcript library used by people just like you to quickly perform preliminary diligence on new ideas related to their target companies in the tech, media, telecom, healthcare, consumer, and industrial sectors, avoiding the time, hassle, and cost of traditional expert network calls. With over 15,000 on-demand expert call interviews, hundreds of new transcripts added every day, AI smart search technology, and 70% of experts unique to their network, it's no wonder the world's leading financial firms choose Stream. For the Best Investment Writing Series, we'll be donating the money from Stream to the charity of each author's choice. So thank you to Stream for sponsoring this episode. To show your appreciation, be sure to visit streamrg.co/meb to sign up to get a 14-day free trial with no credit card required. Once again, that's streamrg.co/meb for your free 14-day trial with no payment method required. Enough from me. Let's get to our guests and let them take over this special episode.
Hi there. This is Whitney Baker, founder of Totem Macro. Totem's a boutique hedge fund consultancy and investment firm specializing in emerging markets and global macro. You can find us at totemmacro.com or on Twitter at Totem Macro. Before we get to the piece, I'd like to thank Stream by AlphaSense for sponsoring today's episode. That money is being donated to the ASPCA. Listeners will be pleased to know that this election's been vetted by Totem's honorary canine chairwoman. Now, let's get into the episode, shall we? I'll be reading Totem's piece called Put Down, published December 13th, 2021. Put Down. We strongly believe whole swathes of dollar and dollar-linked assets are in a bubble, the extremity of which we're unlikely to see ever again in our investing careers. To sum up, we've got a once-in-a-lifetime bubble in the U.S. and a once-in-a-generation value opportunity in broad sections of EM. Those two things aren't exactly unrelated. Just like the 20s and the 90s, the U.S. bubble has sucked all the oxygen out of the rest of the world. But bubbles die when the flows that drove them slow, because there's no space for folks to own even more than they already do, or when they reverse, which always happens when rate hikes follow bubbles. After this bizarro year, there can be no doubt that everyone's already all in. Now we expect faster than price rate hikes well within range, 6 months out or less. We've said countless times that this money-fueled everything bubble would only end with inflation, because QE drove it, both directly and indirectly via monetized fiscal, and because that would be the moment the Fed's hands would be tied. The put would be down, and valuations would adjust for higher rates. The inflation's been plain as day for well over a year, but this vampire bubble still lived on. The Fed sold the market this transitory inflation bullshit this whole time, and the market, cue to the post-GFC deflation script, and not this exploding liquidity script, bought it. And to be clear, the market had no incentive to question it, as long as the Fed stuck to the script. It takes a while for people to change tack when the buy the dip is, for many market noobs, all they've ever known, and when it's paid out 100% of the time. But the Fed is no longer sticking to the script. Even they are willing to admit they were wrong, albeit in language reminiscent of Clinton-esque obfuscation. Quote unquote, depends on what the meaning of the word transitory is. We've believed that as long as yields and inflation were rising from low levels, like always after recessions, risk assets would do well. We said get worried when inflation becomes a problem and when short-end hikes are aggressively pulled forward. That is now. And the truth is, market valuations are way more extreme now than when we said that. All the signposts we describe in our June 2020 report, How This Ends, are now lining up in a way that, at least to us, makes this the dip not to buy. We continue to lean into the rotation, and we now expect it to be a bearish one. At the end of a bizarro year, now getting a lens into the future. This almost goes without saying, but this year has been extremely unusual. It was by no means obvious that the record-breaking everything bubble would not only sustain but become even more extreme in the face of massive inflation, or that the rotation to play for was within the tech sector itself, with the five biggest tech stocks generating substantially all global equity returns, even while the rest of the NASDAQ would fall by double digits, or that inflation hedges didn't work well, and the long end didn't move much, despite points one and two, or that commodity prices would surge, reformed debtor, quote-unquote, EMs, would have greater current account surpluses than ever before, and yet EMFX would be flat, also not obvious. The only reason for all of these things, in short, that macro conditions have unfolded as expected, but the assets that typically hinge on them haven't followed, is rates. It's been a year of folks playing this bubble to its logical death, even though the conditions that it thrived on themselves are long since dead. This whole thing collapses when rates rise. During November's risk-off action, which, let's remember, was driven by A, a marginally inflationary virus development, and B, the Fed explicitly telling you it doesn't have your back anymore, the market still, quote-unquote, de-risked in this episode by fleeing to treasuries. It's time to get ready for what happens when the market internalizes that the Fed put no longer exists, when inflation and yields rising together is what's causing the risk off. The last few weeks were a lens into what that looks like, with the exception that bonds will offer you no protection in that environment. They'll add to the losses. What this means is we're in for a historically unusual period of cash out performance versus nearly all DM assets, especially dollar ones, in our view, which is pretty bearish considering cash will deliver negative real returns. But within that environment, there'll be playable risk rotation internals, geographic dispersion, and we'd expect inflation hedge outperformance, because even if the Fed double speed tapers and hikes, they'll still lag what's needed to bring inflation down. To be ultra clear, here's what we expect to happen along the major asset class dimensions. Rates. The long end's been held down by a lack of term issuance after Fed purchases, and the growth slowdown this year. We believe that's over as bond supply is inflecting much higher in a sustained way, and inflation will remain extremely elevated until sometime well after corrective action is finally taken, brackets, monetary tightening. Equities. We're increasingly convinced the bubble is dead or very close to dying, and that this bounce will prove ephemeral. We believe the steady march higher in yields will attach a discount rate and risk premium to loss-making, nosebleed valuation stocks and sectors. The huge narrowing of breadth is a classic end-of-bubble hallmark. Equity internals. Because of points one and two, we expect U.S. and dollar-linked assets to severely underperform cyclical value plays, especially in distressed markets with rate and inflation protection, like many in EMX Asia. Tech carnage. The tech sector is in for a world of pain. Part of the reason FANG is the only thing that's performing is that it's increasingly taking slash absorbing all profitable cash flows in the sector. The vast majority of other new economy tech and tech software companies are loss-making and dependent on revenues from within the sector itself. That is to say, each tech company's revenues are in large part derived from the rest of the sector's losses. The problem with simultaneously tighter liquidity, rising rates, and stock price losses is that folks won't be willing to finance those cash flow gaps forever, and where they are willing, they'll do so at much more normal valuations. Many companies within subsectors that cumulatively imply astronomical market caps, e.g. EVs, SaaS, won't survive, thus starting a vicious downward spiral of sector-wide revenues, and we expect failures. Dollar. When the dollar everything bubble cracks, so will the dollar. As we show below, in many ways, the dollar is today what EMFX was in 2013, extremely dependent on foreign flows into domestic bubble assets, and extremely overvalued as a result of those flows, with twin deficits, soaring inflation, and a central bank that's well behind. Inflation hedges. Even though tightening will come, real rates will continue to deteriorate and extend longer across the curve because that tightening will be too late and too slow. Traditional hedges that work during currency debasement-driven inflation, precious metals, broader commodities, cyclical inflation assets that can capture elevated nominal GDP as profit and not just revenue, will rise to the fore, and we expect outperform materially. Others like tips will do less well, but still probably okay in real terms. Crypto slash bubble assets. We invest in what we know, in areas where our macro frameworks and signals explain the majority of what's going on. Crypto is not something we know much about or something that has enough history to understand well. That said, our guess is it'll prove to be ultra vulnerable to the end of this bubble, as retail-driven frothy assets typically are. We would guess this will help turbocharge precious metals. In stocks, we expect more risk-off and a lengthy rotation. The charts below zero in on the recent risk-off episode, which had some interesting characteristics that portend the future. They index to November's S&P 500 peak, and pink shading shows days when U.S. indices were off by more than 1%. Initially, the risk-off was broad-based, but throughout the episode and on later down days, U.S. stocks did significantly worse than EM stocks, which nobody owns and therefore don't get liquidated as aggressively. DMXUS did even worse, because that's where the new virus restrictions are being applied with the most vim, and because the virus and central bank tightening were seen ultimately as global growth drags. We expect all to outperform U.S. stocks in the future. It's also telling that the SPX, FANG, and the rest of U.S. tech all did just as badly as each other, but in classic Pavlovian fashion, FANG bounced back. Rising yields will recondition that response. And whether we look at meme stocks, post-deal SPACs, or ARK as a decent proxy for loss-making tech, in other words, the assets most characteristic of this bubble, with the most recent inflows, they did horrendously and didn't bounce back. When the dollar everything bubble cracks, so does the dollar. The year-to-date dollar rally followed the 2018 playbook. Stronger fiscal impulse in the U.S. equals growth will be better in the U.S. equals short-end tightening being pulled forward equals dollar rally and cross-currency basis issues reappearing. But in trade-weighted terms, the dollar rally hit DMFX spot and EM tighteners by around the same amount, but was less bad for EMs that aren't hiking and don't have much inflation. That said, total returns in EMFX across the two groups were comparable and much better than DMFX because the hikers at least offer 4% carry on average. This time around, there wasn't any dollar credit going into EM in the same way there was in 2018. Recall, 2017 was the strongest ever year for hard currency inflows into EM bonds, as an example. Current accounts are in large surplus and rates are materially higher. This is why, when it comes to taper and rates, you need to worry about the USA. It's where the flows are going, where inflation is acute, and yet where they're doing nothing about it. U.S. stocks, especially FANG, still rose with the dollar this year. But when there's broad-based risk off, non-dollar G7 currencies, i.e. alternative reserve currencies, rallied, and the dollar sold off. The dollar sell-off during the Black Friday market rout and the risk-off days since was a window into the dollar's future. This is explained by the idea that the huge recipient of both carry flows within DM and risky asset flows this cycle, post-2013 taper or Fed liftoff, was the USA. We truly believe that when this everything bubble cracks, the dollar will crack too, as was the case post.com. Foreigners already ceased their rampant buying of U.S. stocks. When U.S. tech started to underperform EM stocks in the rout, EMFX actually rallied on U.S. equity risk-off days. Meanwhile, we won't get the classic dollar squeeze dynamic in risk-off because that normally comes from an unwind of carry trades, and the dollar has not been funding any carry trades for the last 7 years, even intra-G7. It's been on the receiving end of carry flows. Crypto's performance, selling down alongside tech, is also telling. As risk does badly, focus returns to protecting capital. Up until very recently, no one's eye was on how to protect their capital. It was on how to flip pre-deal SPACs trading above 10 bucks and how to chase unsustainable bubble gains in meme stocks, crypto, NFTs, story tech, and all manner of U.S. risk assets. That's starting to change alongside the inflation narrative. But this risk-off episode didn't show any love to traditional inflation assets like commodities and precious metals, while break-even inflation and nominal yields actually fell. So this is the big exception to extrapolating the recent market moves. Markets are still pricing risk-off as if it will somehow bring about some magical deflationary wave that holds yields down and more forward Fed support, e.g. slower hikes, some concept of a downside put. In other words, the market's still reading risk off like it's a deflationary growth shock. but inflation is entrenched, and even the Fed is now telling the market it's on its own. Amerizil. U.S. politicians have learned from the absolute best. U.S. fiscal shock and awe is causing inflation. From a flows perspective, we have extreme amounts of credit creation, both fiscal and private, and rapid money printing all at the same time. Post-GFC, we had money printing that was just sufficient to offset contracting credit. That's why there wasn't an explosion in broad money growth / financing then, like there is today, and why this is inflationary, while back then, money printing was just an offset to a huge deflationary credit crunch. Considering U.S. demand is responsible for circa 90% of incremental global durable goods spending, and that global inflation is more correlated than ever before, there's a strong case the U.S. is global inflation enemy number one. In the 2000s, the term Chimerica came to represent the virtuous self-reinforcing dependency between the U.S. and China, where cheap Chinese goods got sold to U.S. consumers, expanding U.S. trade deficits that were financed by China's recycling of those export-driven surpluses back into U.S. bonds and other assets. The U.S. consumers in that cycle financed those same purchases by taking on huge amounts of debt, both reflecting and creating the housing bubble, and ultimately paving the way for the subprime crisis. The virus took that mercantilist model to its logical extreme, with consumer goods purchases financed directly by fiscal transfers instead of debt. But the problem is, as an expensive dollar-linked currency, China doesn't have external surpluses to recycle anymore, and it's long since depegged from the dollar, as have petrocurrencies mostly, and other previously pegged EMFX. There are no automatic foreign official purchases of U.S. debt this time around. The buyer of U.S. debt is the Fed. Any seasoned EM investor knows what happens next. When a country runs a twin deficit with an overvalued currency, an overheating economy, an inflation surge, and deeply negative real rates, the currency falls, rates rise, equities sell off. An external adjustment then occurs because domestic tightening and foreign selling stifles demand and chokes off imports. That balance of payments downswing was fully in force for EM during the 2013 plus taper tantrum and U.S. hiking cycle because it was EMs who were doing those mischievous things. This time it's the USA. So we propose an alternative gimmicky name, Amerizil. This time, it's a two-party suicide pact of money-financed fiscal. America is the new Brazil. So who exactly has been financing this twin doom loop of expanding current account deficits and consumer booms? Why, foreigners buying booming equities and other bubble assets, of course. Low rates throughout this cycle and for Brazil since 2015 have propelled stock re-rating and appreciation in both places. Foreigners bought in large. You can see on the left chart that U.S. stocks are trading in their 99th percentile, valuation-wise, a level not seen since the dot-com craze. Brazilian stocks were similarly rich in a massive divergence from other post-balance of payments adjustment EMs, what we like to call the reformed debtors, until Brazil was forced to start hiking in a huge way, prompting outsized equity losses, foreign withdrawal, and the growth adjustment described above. Meanwhile, EM debtors are trading extremely cheap, just like after the dot-com, and they now own more foreign equities than foreigners own of theirs. Who will be sensitive to taper and rate-driven risk off? Not those guys. They may actually unwind their own foreign equity ownership, conspiring with their booming current account surpluses to drive material FX gains. In the early part of this risk-off environment, their stocks may not rise outright, but at a minimum, they shouldn't fall as materially, hence bearish rotation. Checking in on the evolving global growth inflation mix. Growth was slowing well before Omicron, due in large part to policy reactions to Delta. The reality is variants will continue to develop. In highly vaccinated populations, there's very few serious health outcomes, and yet policymakers are responding with extremely disproportionate measures regardless. What happened to 2 weeks to slow the spread? Maybe this is just our love of freedom speaking, but it seems we're still under martial law a full year after VE Day. In today's terms, Vaccine Efficacy Day. It's not unlike Elizabeth Warren's never-ending bank-bashing political haymaking nigh on a decade after the banking crisis was already resolved. Bottom line, anti-growth restrictions are not costless, and we fear we are now entering a world where they continue with this in the face of much more constrained policy flexibility. At the margin, this risks exacerbating goods demand even more by curtailing the services switch we described below, worsening inflation broadly, especially given zero COVID tolerance policies across much of goods producing Asia, and giving central banks more cover to let inflation run, which sets us up for a more vicious catch-up and violent market correction later. We are now at risk of a 70-style market rout with no Fed put available. We know inflation is now endemic and globalized. We know the second round effects of it are present and exacerbating it. Brackets CapEx booms, labor market tightness slash wage pressure, restocking. We know there's abundant dry powder, e.g. $2.7 trillion of unspent household savings in the U.S. We know that inflation is pernicious precisely because it means spending dry powder is effectively involuntary. Even if folks are cautious and curtail real spending, 75 cents of every dollar being spent is being spent to afford stuff people were already buying. And there's more fiscal coming. In the rest of this report, we check in on the key inflation and growth dynamics at play and what they mean for the future. Inflation. DMs are exporting inflation into EM. Looking at where goods consumption is versus goods production is a neat little way of synthesizing the consumer-driven demand versus supply imbalances in different places. Consumer spending is up the most where consumer incomes are up the most, which is where consumer stimulus payments have been most generous. Unlike DM, EMs have not responded to coronavirus with outsized fiscal stimulus. But EM's not a monolith, and some have. Chile and Brazil are great examples, and have inflation problems like DM. Here's a set of charts comparing extreme global fiscal stimulators, largely DM, versus non-stimulators, largely EM. Fiscal support that propped up household incomes, even as wage income contracted, which is normal in a recession, is the dominant driver of demand versus supply imbalances today, shown with respect to goods in the two left charts below. So as you can see on the right, the acceleration in core CPI versus trough, A, has been most pronounced, and B, continues to accelerate unabated in the fiscal stimulators. The non-stimulators have had less, with minimal further acceleration in core inflation since about March of this year. But essentially, EMs are importing DM irresponsibility via the headline components. World inflation is extremely highly correlated to import prices versus history. The demand shock is obviously acutely hitting goods, which mostly travel by ship, ships and chips, and are therefore imports and exports globally. This, for EM, is imported inflation. So regardless of their fiscal prudence, e.g. stimulus that was proportionate to or less than the COVID income shock, and lower core inflation issues, as shown below, the non-stimulators are importing inflation visibly in the headline components, even if the overall scale of the problem is mitigated by their lower core inflationary pressures. Consumer spending. Observations on EM-DM divergence and services switch. The inflation analysis above shows there were slash are lower levels of retail goods demand within many EM countries versus DMs at large. The EMs supplied the DM demand. The DMs slash stimulators had an early extreme pop in real goods spending, fueling core inflation. But now, DM goods demand is slowing and below its post-COVID peak, while EM goods demand is accelerating as those economies recover, propelled in large part by the flow-through of export-driven external income windfalls, whether they're goods exporters or commodities exporters, resulting tight labor markets and CapEx booms, less fiscal drag, and so on. Asian economies are also adding to the rebound related to the recent loosening of COVID restrictions, especially Singapore, Taiwan, and Malaysia. On a three-month basis, median EM goods demand is flat. The average is plus 10% because of skew from these three countries, while DM is down 4%. We show six-month annualized charts below to cut through the V-shaped Asian chop. The broad point remains, no matter how you slice it, EM goods demand is up from lower levels, while DM goods demand is down, but still high. What about the switch to services demand globally and away from goods? This is happening like it was supposed to upon reopening, but EM is above DM here too in growth terms, meaning we see a pretty clear divergence in total real consumption trends between EM, which is accelerating, and DM, which is decelerating with mix shift. Slack divergence, labor markets tighter, but capacity utilization still low in EM. Putting two and two together above, we show below that labor markets are tight broadly, even though services demand is still only just recovering. In the fiscal stimulators, this is some combo of labor force reduction slash falling participation slash early retirement, visible in the DM stimulator types, and lots of hiring going on for both goods and services in the non-stimulators, plus also some reduced participation there driving this. So already tight labor is potentially a forward problem for incremental DM services supply and inflation more broadly. Labor is, of course, the dominant input into services pricing. As services spending ramps up, in EM, services productivity can still expand, i.e. services hiring has outpaced the normalization in services demand. But also, manufacturing capacity utilization is getting tighter, especially in the DM, while at the same time, the EM is now accelerating its own goods demand. Clearly, EM had tons of slack post-COVID to cater to the surge in goods demand, and they still have the ability to ramp up further in theory, but logistics and shipping problems persist, and there are broad-based shortages in foundational goods components like semiconductors. So these are just more points on inflation not being transitory and the marginal ability to supply even more goods far from demand centers being constrained, and services, especially in the USA, the champion fiscal stimulator. On the wage side, EM, in simple average terms, wage growth is more or less where it always is in nominal terms, a smidge elevated versus the post-GFC period. And real wages are similarly positive, using both headline and core CPI, within their usual ranges. But in DM, there's been a steady nominal wage growth breakout versus the post-1980s range, back to where we were during the 2000s boom. On the wage side, EM average wage growth is more or less where it always is in nominal terms, a smidge elevated versus the post-GFC period. And real wages are similarly positive, using both headline and core CPI, within their usual ranges. But in DM, there's been a steady nominal wage growth breakout versus the post-GFC range, back to where we were during the 2000s boom. The issue for these households is real wages are negative, even more had we used three-month inflation reads, as their spending, just like their overall income, has outpaced nominal wages. Tracking CapEx booms, another demand driver and a credit accelerator. On top of all of the above, e.g., still high global goods demand, albeit with DM versus EM divergences, amidst increasingly tight capacity, an ongoing switch to services amidst increasingly tight labor markets, and overall, the clear inflation problems generated by DM overstimulators but being felt broadly via imports of headline components everywhere, we also have a CapEx boom. That just increases demand further and supply only later. This is also most pronounced in the DM versus pre-COVID levels. But under the hood within EM, the commodity folks are seeing some pretty big CapEx rebounds versus the others, consistent with the slack divergences shown above. This is important for two reasons. It adds another player to the goods demand bonanza, globally but especially visible in DMs and commodity-producing countries that require capital goods for investment. And it will accelerate private credit flows related to financing these projects and CapEx expansions. Private credit creation never went negative in DM in this COVID crisis, just like household income. Mortgages, corporates drawing down credit lines, the absolutely huge surge in corporate credit issuance since. This is, of course, a key difference between what happened post-GFC when all the money in fiscal was designed to offset a huge deleveraging pressure. As you can see below, over the last 6 months, private credit is reasonably positive in most places, particularly outside Asia, even before CapEx funding is really needed. But saying that, private credit creation is only now becoming a big contributor financing-wise to the global demand surge. There's plenty of scope for acceleration, and CapEx booms in response to goods and commodity tightness, plus infrastructure drives and so on, will drive the corporate side, We believe the markets with steeply negative real rates, low nominal rates, and high credit flows are going to be the most economically sensitive to impending / ongoing hiking cycles. Those in the green quadrant probably are not as bad. A final parting thought. The way tightening can help with an inflation problem is always and universally by slowing demand. It's not that the Fed hiking magically brings a new advanced nanomode fab on stream. But as we showed in inflation pandemic, this is a demand shock, not a supply shock. Supply of everything is well above prior all-time highs. We have real concerns that rate hikes will be less effective in slowing demand this time around for a variety of reasons. So in addition to all our concerns on inflation and its non-transitoriness, we're worried about the ability to tighten effectively via interest rates, particularly in the context of what will be higher through the cycle DM fiscal spending and trigger happiness with respect to lockdowns. This may mean we need even more hikes than normal, and what's normal is 2 to 4 points. That's because, A, this overheating is not fueled by a private credit cycle, which is the normal channel by which rate hikes work to slow growth. It's not like it's 2006 and a hiking cycle will pop a credit boom. B, fiscal ain't slowing much anytime soon, especially in the USA, and it would be hard to contract the dry powder that's already been transferred, absent an outright fiscal tightening and a massive tax hike on the poorest folks who have the dry powder and have the highest propensity to spend it on things in the broad CPI basket. Highly unlikely, to say the least. C, the private credit acceleration is now happening, and we believe will continue due to CapEx booms, with this particular form of credit being less rate sensitive because it's bonds / more fixed rate, and once you start a project, you kind of have to finish it. D, in the DM, much of the CapEx is housing related, something that doesn't ever contribute to disinflationary goods supply. And we know that the crazy house price booms that have happened almost everywhere are still going to flow through to inflation with a lag. The U.S. CPI, for instance, currently has shelter inflation at 3.8% year over year, while house prices are up 20%. This will continue to pressure the numbers well after tightening has begun, absent a housing collapse.